This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2019, held on March 22 and 23, 2019, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Good afternoon. This is the last one in the afternoon before the two general sessions, so it'll be somewhat interactive. I hope you can talk to each other while we're here in the room. If you're like me, you like people, and I think people is the business that God is in, right? He's in the business of people. And it's interesting when we meet people that we don't notice certain things and we notice other things. Like, have you been watching people here at Reach today? And I find that when we look at people, we notice the things that are different about them, like how they're different than us. We don't notice the ways that they're alike or they're like us. Have you noticed that before? So, like, what are some of the things you notice about people when you see them? You notice they're... Oh, we're not going to talk. Okay, talk to each other then. What are some things? Talk to each other a little bit. Turn to somebody you don't know and tell them something you notice about them that's different than you. Go. Okay, now we'll pull it back together here. What's something you said? What do you notice about another person that's different than you? Their hair color. What else? Pardon? Their eye color. We may notice skin color. We tend to notice how people are different than us and not how they're alike us and not how they're like us. In reality, actually, we're much more alike than different. Now that we can sequence DNA, we know that people really are 99.9% alike. So if someone from the sub-Saharan Africa meets somebody like me that's all bleached out from, Germanic background, we're 99.9% alike in terms of our DNA. Another way of saying that is this: of all your DNA bases that make up your genetic code, out of every 1,200 to 1,500 DNA bases, only about one or two is different between you and the person standing beside you. So if you look at a picture of us at Reach this morning, there were what, about 2,000 people there this morning? The difference between your DNA and the person beside you is change out about two people in the audience if they represent bases of DNA. And somebody else would be looking on, they would say, oh, there's nothing different in that audience, right? It's just two people hardly makes a difference. We're really alike. And it's not just biologically that we're alike. We're also alike at the level of our psyche, what makes us tick, what we get depressed about, what we get excited about. We're really quite alike. And God has wired us that way. He's really made us a lot of alike. And one of the ways he's wired us, I think, is that he's wired us for mission. All of us, I believe, are wired to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. God made us this way. Mission has to do with sending out on a task that's bigger than our own individual purpose. Another way of saying that is this: for all of us, me is not enough. We have a soul longing to be a part of something bigger than just me. And I'm convinced it's not just Christians that know this. The U.S. military understands this. Look at this ad from the U.S. Marine Corps, I think about 2016. Notice that the way they're getting people to join the military, and this was an ad campaign specifically for women going into combat roles, was saying that we all deep down inside long for something more than a paycheck. We want to be on mission, something bigger than ourselves. We also see this in the sort of people we want to be, or that we pick to be our heroes. Think about who your heroes are. They are people that apply themselves, put themselves into something bigger than just themselves. I had the privilege when I was a child, one of the highlights of my childhood was to meet one of my heroes. This is Bruce Olson. You may know him as Brutchko. Have you read the book about Brutchko and know his story, how he was just a teenager, flew to Venezuela with $70 in his pocket because he felt the Lord was calling him to go to a people group. He wasn't supported by his parents. His parents were nominal Lutherans who rejected his born-again Christianity. And he lands in Venezuela with hardly any money and eventually learns about this tribe of people called the Multilone people who basically kill outsiders when they see them, and had killed a bunch of oil employees, and he decided that he wanted to go in and meet that group of people. And so he goes in on a mission to meet this group of people. He barters his way through another Indian group. He offers a zipper to some Indian native guy to haul him way down into the jungle. And he meets the Modalones at the end of a spear, the guy that he gets shot. Actually, it's an arrow. I think he gets shot. And the man walks up to him and just puts his foot on his leg, on his thigh, and pulls the arrow out. And that's how he met the Modalone people. I met Bruce Olson right after he had been captured by Marxist guerrillas and held for 6 months. He's a small man. He spoke somewhat broken English. He would periodically forget words because he had so devoted himself to a mission that he was losing his English, at least a little bit of his English. And he told about being there with those guerrillas and how he was captured and he was pushed down into the mud, face down into the mud with a gun behind his head. And he thought, well, this is the way my life will end. But they hauled him for 3 days. He walked forced march into the jungle, and he was guarded 24 hours a day. He had malaria, and the men were constantly sick. They were spitting all the time. And when you spit all the time and you're sick, then it contaminates your water supply. And so he taught one of them how to be a nurse. And then he taught them how to cook wonderful sauces out of palm grubs, a skill he had learned. And he made bread for the camp 3 times a week. And he wrote love letters for illiterate guerrillas who needed to write to their girlfriends, but they couldn't write. And so Bruce Olson would write their love letters for him. And he was forced to sleep out in unprotected areas. And there were these jungle downpours of rain. And he began sharing his faith with his fellow, not his fellow captors, with his fellow camp members who were his captors. And eventually some of them came to know the Lord. One day he had lost a tremendous amount of blood and needed 2 pints, quarts, liters, units, whatever they come in, of blood. And the men fought over who could give him blood. His captors wanted to give him blood. And finally, just soon before I met him, he was hauled out in front of a firing squad. He was told that he was to be executed, and they lined up. And so at least one of the men was crying because he did not want to pull the trigger. And he was tied up. They raised their guns. The command came to fire, and they fired their weapons. And there was noise, but there was no bullet because the commander had ordered them to put blanks in their guns. Why do we look up to people like Bruce Olson? It's because they devote their lives to something bigger themselves. I think we're all wired for mission. Jesus knew something about living on mission, didn't he? As a kid, he told his mom that he was about his father's business. He knew his dad was up to something. He knew God was up to something, and he was on that business. And later, Jesus stood in the synagogue, and he said these words that we've heard over and over today. He said, God has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives. I think that as followers of Jesus, we have a sense that we too should be about our Father's business. But I wonder, do we have a good sense of what our Father's business really is? Or is it muddled? Is it muddy? Is it not clear to us? What is my Father's business? What is God's mission in the world? And then, if I can figure that out, what am I supposed to be doing about it? With God's, how am I supposed to plug into God's mission? And so that's really what I'm going to do today. I want to help us clarify what really is God doing in the world. That brings a lot of clarity to me. Then I can figure out whether I'm plugged into that, and then I'm going to provide some ways for us to think about how can I make sure that I can get plugged into what God is doing. And I see we have a wide variety of age here. I was expecting more younger than older, and I see we're kind of mixed, and so hope something I say here can fit into your life, especially as we get into how do I plug in. I want you to picture a aircraft carrier briefing room. This is from the USS Yorktown, which sits in the Charleston Harbor. I'm from South Carolina, and before the pilots in World War II would go out on their mission, on their runs, they would meet in the briefing room, and the commander up front would brief them, or whoever was in charge of this, on their mission. And that's actually kind of the posture that I want us to take here today. This is a briefing room, and what I'd like to do is help us think together, using the Word of God, what is the mission that we're on? Very clearly try to state that, and then talk about what's the plan to execute that mission, how we can go about that mission. So do we know where we're at? Okay, 2 questions really here, and it's, what is the mission? How do I plug in? So we're going to do a little Bible study here, and I've developed this little outline timeline for you as a way to help us track along with what the Bible has to say about God's mission. I believe that God announces his mission to us quite clearly in the Bible, and it's in the first chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 12. Because I don't think the Bible really starts until Genesis chapter 12 in terms of the real story. I believe that everything before that is really a prologue. It's an introduction to what starts in Genesis chapter 12. Now, I'm going to try to make a quick case here for why I think Genesis 1 through 11 are a prologue to the Bible. They're a prologue because those first 11 chapters set up the need for the mission. The question is, why does God need to be on mission? Well, Genesis 1 through 11 answer that question. One of the ways we can sense that it's a prologue, it's an introduction, has to do with time. How much time transpires in Genesis 1 through 11? At least 1,500 years. It's like one of my professors said, it's like being on an interstate highway. You're just flying along, and then periodically God will get off on an exit and tell you a little story in Genesis 1 through 11, and then he jumps back on the interstate highway and flies along some more, and then he pauses and tells us a little story. And then you get to Genesis chapter 12, and all the rest of the chapters in Genesis only take something like 250 years. So the first 11 chapters are 1,500, and then from Genesis 12 to the end of the book, you have 250 years. That gives us a clue that something different is happening in those first 11 chapters. Second, I think the content of Genesis 1 through 11 is introductory in nature. So what do we learn in this introduction? We learn that God created people for relationship. He created them for relationship with himself. He created them for relationship with people. We also meet a God who is in the business of blessing people. Take a look at this. So here's Genesis chapter 1, verse 22. God makes birds and God makes fish. Are those both up there? Fish and birds, something in that order. And then God says what? He makes the animals and then he... Yeah, y'all can talk, so let's talk together here. So God then does what? He blesses them. And then he makes humans. Verse 28, and what does he do when he makes humans? Notice chapter 5, verse 2, when he comes circling back around to talk about the creation, he says he makes them, and he talks about making mankind, and he says again he blesses them. God over and over again uses this word blessing. I made you, and I bless you. And humans, I made you, and I bless you. And then, by the way, I made the humans, and I bless them. God is a blessing God. We're also introduced to the central human problem, which is called sin. And we find out that sin is a brokenness in relationship. When humans sin, they lose a proper relationship with themselves. They no longer relate to themselves properly. They no longer relate to other individuals properly. They no longer relate to families properly. And they no longer relate to large groups of people properly. And there's a brokenness in relationship, and there's a rippling effect as those broken relationships go out. And so God sends a flood. And then notice what happens at the end of the flood. Once the flood comes and he takes the few people remaining, what does he do again to them? He says, I will, to Noah, I will bless you. So what did we spot? We see a God who makes us for relationship. He is in the business of blessing. There's the problem of sin, but he still keeps coming back to blessing. And then we get to what I think is one of the sad chapters in the Bible. I just realized recently how sad this chapter is. It's Genesis chapter 12, right before the mission is going to get announced. And we have these people coming together to build a tower. And God's looking down, people that he would like to bless, people that he would like to have a relationship with. And he realizes, I have to scatter them all over the earth. And they're going to go and start having families and making nations. And they're not going to know of me, but I'm forced to do this. And can you imagine how sad it must have been for God to watch those groups of people heading off over the face of the earth? And he said, I made these people for relationship. I made to bless them. And now they're gone. And they're going to go live in jungles and deserts. And how many years will it be till they know that I want a relationship with them? It's a sad day. And then God inserts himself into the story, Genesis 12, and here we go. Into the tragedy, God starts the story, and he announces his mission. So do you know Genesis 12, 1 through 3? How many times does it say the word bless in Genesis 12, 1 through 3? And so let's read it together. He says, now the Lord had said to Abram, read together with me, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. God chooses Abraham to start on a mission of blessing. He will bless all the nations of the earth through Abraham. And it was inspiring to me when I realized this is not the last time God talks about this in the Bible. I believe that that is God's mission. God is on a mission to bless all the families of the earth, all the nations of the earth through Abraham. So God gets to work and starts building a nation. The arrow coming down is the mission announced. That's Genesis 12, 1 through 3, if you want to put the reference in. So the mission is announced to Abraham. And God starts building a channel through which he will bring something to the world, blessing to the world. Now, I have a question for you. What is the biggest blessing that the world needs? If you're going to name, I mean, the world needs a lot of things, right? It needs food, it needs safety, the world needs a lot of things. But what's the biggest blessing? If you're going to bless someone that you meet on the street with the greatest blessing you could give them, what would you do to them? A relationship with God. Isn't that the ultimate blessing that God could bring? And so God is going to do that through who? Through Jesus. And so God starts preparing a channel, a conduit, a way to bring Jesus into the world. And let's just walk through it very rapidly. God is going to build a great nation. And so to have a nation, you have to have some things. You have to have people, and you have to have land, and you have to have laws. You have to have leaders, and you know the story. So we're going to go really fast here. So God says, I'm going to build a nation, and so he picks Abraham, and Abraham is kind of a problem to build a nation with because Abraham doesn't have any. He doesn't have any children, so God gave him one, and then Isaac doesn't have any children. He only has how many? Well, I don't know, but one that actually ends up going anywhere with this nation business. And then that man has a number of wives. You know that story? They sort of have what one of my professors called a baby-making contest. And so you have Rachel and Leah sort of going back and forth at it, who can have babies. And it's interesting that in the book of Ruth, the Bible says that those were the ladies who built the house of Israel. Ruth 4, verse 11. Rachel and Leah built the nation with their 12 children. And then God needed a place for this nation to incubate. And so he goes around and says, well, what's the best spot in the world to incubate a nation? Incognito. And he finds the greatest empire in the world. And so he's got to find a way to get those people down to that empire. And so he gets a secret, you know, infiltrator to infiltrate behind enemy lines. And that guy's name is Joseph. And so he goes down there and he spends some time, and God finds a way for him to intersect with the Pharaoh, and he does all that business. And finally, all the Israelites get down to the land of Goshen, and they become a great nation right there in Egypt. You see, God is on a mission. That wasn't a mistake that they ended up in Egypt. So they're there for 300 years, and God has to have a way to birth that nation out to Canaan. So if you want to, you know, birth and you want to be excited about having a baby, just involve some pain in there, and then everybody's really happy to have the baby. And so they have the, you know, the slavery thing happens, and then are the Israelites happy to get out of Egypt? For a little while, right? They're happy to get out of Egypt. And they go wandering around, and they eventually get to their land, and they eventually become a great nation. And you have David and Solomon, and David in his Psalms keeps reminding the people of Israel that God is interested in all the nations. You can go and find those Psalms where he talks about all the nations. And then what happens? They have a great nation, and the great nation is broken apart. Is God still on mission? Is God still doing something? Yes, he is. Because of all those people that get scattered by the Assyrian Empire and by the Babylonians, how many come back? About 50,000. Where are the rest of them? Well, the rest of them are scattered through all 127 of the Assyrian provinces. There's a Jew in every single Assyrian province. And God uses this diaspora of people, and I just have some little people drawn in there, people groups, in all the known world that are seeding the world. Do you remember in the book of Acts at the day of Pentecost, and all those people came back to Jerusalem, all those Jewish people? Where did they come from? Well, those are the descendants of these people. So even in the collapse of Israel and the scattering and dividing, God is still on mission. He's still doing something so that the world will be blessed through Abraham. And so finally, Jesus comes, And he slips into the world pretty quietly for God. And he finally brings the ultimate blessing to all the world. And we know this because of a wonderful passage in Galatians chapter 3 that connects Jesus with the promise to Abraham. And if we had our Bibles, we could open up to Galatians chapter 3, but I want us to just read that text together. Would you read it with me? This is like the chill-inducing verse in the Bible. Let's read it. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. When God said that to Abraham, he was preaching the gospel. The gospel, the good news of Jesus, is that all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And we could jump all the way ahead to the end of the ages. And who is going to be in heaven? All nations and tribes of people that were blessed by God's mission. God is on a mission. His mission, just to be very clear, is to bless all the nations of the world with the redemption found in Jesus Christ. And God's mission did not start with the Great Commission. It started in Genesis chapter 12. Of course, God knew it before then even. But in Genesis chapter 12, God announces what his mission is. And that mission is ongoing. Jesus was sent by God to come to the earth. And in John chapter 20, verse 21, what happens? As the Father has sent me, Jesus is the pivot figure, Jesus now says, so send I you. We're still on mission. All of us should be able to answer this question, how are we plugging in to God's mission? Are you in some way plugging in to making sure that God's blessing is going to be on all the peoples of the earth, including your neighbors? Okay, so includes everyone on the earth. Now, I'd like for us to think a little bit as we look back over that quick little history about some characteristics of God's mission. And so I've listed four characteristics of God's mission that I think we should pay attention to as we then look at how can I get involved. So the first one is this. The mission of God is people-focused and global. It's all nations of the earth will be blessed. And like I said at the beginning, God is in the people business. As believers, we'd better be in the people business in one way or another. It's kind of hard to be a believer and say, I just never want to interact or intersect with people at all. Now, it doesn't mean that God doesn't need some of you in the archives researching something, but you should be doing it so that you bless people ultimately, okay? So there are roles for people that are not people. You do realize that people are the greatest piece of nature God created, okay? You know, how many of y'all like to hunt? Do you like to hunt? Do you like to fish? All right, do y'all like to go out in nature and take pictures of beautiful sunsets? Okay, nature's cool. But when God made nature, he said that it was what? Good. But then he made people and he said it was very good. So the next time you're on a subway train or you're in the metro in Washington, D.C. or somewhere and you're cramped around people, remind yourself that you're still in nature. You can be a nature lover and live in the middle of a city. And actually, it's God's greatest creation there. So I'm not a hunter. Can you tell? The mission is God empowered. I don't want to jump back to that previous slide, but when God said, I will bless you and make you and all this business like that, over and over again, he repeated a word, two words. Do you remember what they were other than blessed that were repeated over and over again? God said, I will. And he says, I will, I will, I will, I will. God is doing this thing. It is God empowered. He didn't say, Abraham, you go and have a great nation, and you go and bless all the people. He said, through you, I will. God is doing this. The third characteristic of God's mission is that God is deliberate. How long did it take for Jesus to get here? Quite a bit of time, right? God grows things. Jack Lehman, one of the men who taught me, said this is the acorn principle. How does an oak tree start? From an acorn. And it gets really big eventually. But God is deliberate. He takes time. He grows things. His mission is advancing, but it is deliberate and in his time. Fourthly, the mission is accomplished through us. Calling and sending is God's pattern of working. Who did he call originally to start this mission? Abraham. He called him and he sent him. Think about Joseph, called and sent. Moses, called and sent. Paul, called and sent. Jesus, called and sent. Now it's our turn. We are called and sent on mission. And that doesn't necessarily mean moving geographically, but it's moving out in whatever sphere of influence we're a part. That is the way God does his mission. He does it through people, and he calls people, and he sends people. So how can I get involved? How can you get involved in this mission? And I'd like for us to think about three specific areas for us to be involved. How do I prepare to be on mission? How do I... Are there things that I have to let go to be a part of God's mission? And what does it look like to pursue and follow this mission? Remember the mission. The mission is, God's mission is to what? Let's just go through that again. To bless all the nations, and ultimately it is connected to the redemption that's found in Jesus Christ. All right. Now, that involves a lot of other things, right? Care for people and health care and all kinds of ways. He's in the blessing business, blessing people. The first thing I would say about preparation is this. The pattern of Scripture does seem to me that God prepares people. He doesn't always use traditional means. Like, Moses' preparation was somewhat non-traditional. You know, go out and spend 40 years with sheep sort of thing. Paul's was probably quite traditional. The disciples had 3 years of preparation before they went out. David was prepared by taking care of sheep. I took you out of the sheep pens to lead my people Israel. Jesus spent 30 years in preparation. I think that if we're interested in being on mission for God, we need to think about preparation. So the first thing I would urge all of us, and again, I was thinking more in terms of those that are thinking their life is starting, their earlier years of their life, is to say this, that we should always lean into training. Take advantage of anything you can learn at any time in your life. God may use unlikely training to prepare you for his work. My story is this. I grew up on the mission field, and I remember one day riding with my dad in his little Mitsubishi pickup truck, and I said, Dad, when I grow up, I was a high school student, and I said, I want to be a vet. Now, I'm not a vet. If you know me, you might even figure out why in the world I was thinking that. But I wanted to be a vet. And Dad said this, Patrick, if you want to be a vet, vet school is really hard. You need to learn everything you can learn in high school. Take every class you can take. And so I did that. I took chemistry and physics, and I took calculus, and I took class because I was going to be a vet, not knowing that my training towards being a vet was actually God training me to be an educator. See, God does that. But he needed me to dream about being a vet. Maybe I wasn't ready to think about being an educator yet. So lean into any sort of training you can get. Don't decide too soon what you will be doing with training. Just take the training. If it comes, you have an opportunity. Hey, there's a class to learn about, you know, how to evangelize Muslims. So take it. Take it. You don't know. You don't know yet what God may do with that. They say about Steve Jobs, you know, Mr. Apple, that, you know, he dropped out of college, but there was this class that he'd kind of always wanted to take. It didn't fit into his major. Do you know what class it was? Calligraphy. There was a really great calligraphy prof at the school, and he took a calligraphy class, and he said we'd never have the fonts that we would, that Apple was able actually to introduce to the world if Steve Jobs didn't care about calligraphy. It was just kind of a passion of his, a love. And you think about Apple, whether you're an Apple hater or lover, design and creativity, design is something that they've generally done well with. Okay, so you don't know. Take the calligraphy class. God may have you design the anti-Apple or whatever he wants you to do. So lean into the training. Next, embrace testing and sacrifice. So we're thinking about preparation. One is, if you have a chance to learn something, learn it. Whatever age of life you are. Number two, lean into testing. The eighth week of the sixth month of training to become a U.S. Navy SEAL is called Hell Week. It's 5.5 continuous days of training with 4 hours of maximum sleep at night. Only about 25% of the men make it through Hell Week. Actually, the Navy does this early in the training so they can just get rid of all the people that are not going to make it through the training. And they're subjected, the Navy SEALs are subjected to all kinds of almost torture, 200 miles of running, physical training, something like 20 hours a day. They're constantly moving, running, jumping, pushing things through water, swimming, just in motion all the time. And when they do stand, it can be just about as bad because they're wet and there's the cold breeze blowing off of the ocean. And the trainers try to get people to quit. They stand on bullhorns and they holler and they tell people, all you have to do is come ring a bell. We have coffee and donuts right here. They want people to drop out. They try to get them to drop out because you don't want any weak person to be fighting beside you. The Navy SEALs is such a small group that the people that are training, there's a good chance they're going to fight beside the people that are there being that they're training. And so they want all the weak ones to drop out. Hell Week is a test. It's a physical endurance test. It's a mental endurance test. It's an endurance test. But I have a question for you. If you were going to be a Navy SEAL, would you want to go through that week? What if somebody said, you could be a Navy SEAL, but you can just skip Hell Week? Would you say, sure, I'll skip Hell Week? Or would you say, no, you know what? I'm going to go through that. See, they want to take the training. They want that test. It's a part of who they will become. And to go around the test just doesn't work with being a Navy SEAL. Being a Navy SEAL, I made it through Hell Week. Testing and sacrifice are a part of our mission. Even our commander, Jesus Christ, did what? He came here and he sacrificed. And we should expect it and not try to always run away from it, because it's just a part of the mission that we will need to sacrifice. We are tested and sacrificed for a number of reasons. One is that testing confirms whether you're at the right spot in life. It also gives people a chance to watch you perform under that testing. It gives a chance for you to watch yourself. Think about Abraham. Why did he have to sacrifice Isaac? Wasn't it in some ways to confirm that his faith really was in God? So testing confirms where we're at. Testing builds confidence. You can say, well, you know, I survived that. I did that. Now you can go to the next step. Testing conditions us for what God has for us to do. So I'm suggesting, we're thinking here about preparation. I'm suggesting that there are two areas that we are tested in that are important if we're going to be a part of God's mission. And they're these, under testing. One is the test of loyalty. Whose side am I on? We are all loyal to someone or something. Who or what we are loyal to often directs our actions. And there are many voices in our world calling for our loyalty. There's the loyalty to products. When I was younger, it's still around, Tommy Hilfiger, and you could buy the perfume and you could be a Tommy. Is anybody old enough here? A Tommy girl. See, that's loyalty. Brand loyalty. I'm a Tommy girl. I wear Tommy perfume. I wear, you know, so on. So there's loyalty to products. There's also loyalty. There's this push in our culture to be loyal to ourselves. Do what your heart says. Be true to yourself. That's a false loyalty. God wants us to pass the test of being loyal to him. There's also the test of integrity. Are you whole? And I want to just say this. Often the test of integrity has to do with whether we're willing to listen to somebody in authority over us. And to those of you who are on the younger side of this audience, pay attention to whether you can submit yourself to the authority over you. If you're not able to be under authority, you're not going to be able to serve well in a leadership position. And the people around looking for workers, those that are looking at you and saying, could I hire them, or could they go in ministry for me? Could they work for my organization? If they're seeing that you can't be a person of integrity and submit to authority, they're going to pass you over. So the test of authority is significant if we want to be involved in God's mission. So the next one, let go. What are the things we have to let go if we're going to be on mission for God? Let go of self. Life is not about us. It's about God's mission. Like I said, I grew up on the mission field, and I remember one day we were going somewhere in a vehicle, a 15-passenger van, with a mixed group of Puerto Ricans and Caucasians from the United States, and they were our guests that were visiting us from the United States. And Dad told us before we got in that van that under no circumstances, I don't know how he said this, you are not to talk in English. You will talk in Spanish on this ride. It's more important that kids that we're ministering to feel connected than your friends from the States. So you don't talk in English to your friends from the States, you talk in Spanish. Because life isn't about us. It's about the mission that we're involved in. So let go of self. Also, often we get nervous and flustered when God calls us to do things on mission. Often it's because we're thinking about self. If we stop and say, you know what, this is about God's mission, we can get over some of the nerves that we have. For those of you that are young or younger, I also suggest that we should let go of early debt and responsibilities that tie us down unnecessarily. Often God calls us to go, and if we're too tied down too early in life, we miss the opportunity of going. So I'm not a big fan of young people spending too much money on houses and land too early, because all of a sudden they have this debt that it's hard for them to be mobile. Live light if you can. Live light. I realize there are times to invest and things like that, but beware of too much responsibility too soon in life. Thirdly, in terms of being involved in God's mission, pursue opportunities. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with all your might. Now, I'm just going to throw an age out there. Let's say if you are under 30, 25, your default answer whenever you're asked to do something is yes. Make yes your default. Now, when you get 30 to 40, start backing off, because you'll have plenty of things you've said yes to, and then it's time to start narrowing down. But if somebody says, would you teach Vacation Bible School? You say yes, because that's a way to start jumping in and trying things out. They say, would you teach a Bible school or you teach a Sunday school class? Yes. Would you like to go on a short-term mission trip? Yes. Make yes early in life, make yes your default. Later in life, you make no your default. My wife was glad to hear me say that. You never know what saying yes will lead to. There was somebody in our church that was ministering to a World War II veteran, and they were buying groceries for them and things like that, and they were moving out of the community. They said, would y'all take that ministry over? And Bethany and I were just recently married, and we said yes. And, you know, I wouldn't trade vacations for the opportunity of working for Mr. Martin, an underwater demolition Navy SEAL before there ever was such a thing, who told me that he was at the birth of Israel. He was also captured by cannibals during World War II in the Philippines. I didn't believe all this stuff for sure when I started doing research, and there really were people captured by cannibals. He wasn't eaten, just so that you know. One day he sent me back to his closet, and he said, I was sent in on missions to assassinate people by the U.S. military. And he said, go back in my closet, and there are these guns in there. And he said, see that, get that vial or whatever it was. He showed me this vial, and he says, that's where the medicine, the cyanide pills, were to kill myself if I was captured behind enemy lines. Okay, so that was kind of an interesting part, but it was also sitting beside Mr. Martin and him saying, I've lived my whole life serving myself. I don't feel right about begging God to save me. And it was me being able to tell him, no, God has already done this for you. It's a gift. You don't have to beg God. God has already provided salvation. It's just for you to accept that. It's because I said yes that I had the opportunity to be involved in that man's life. Say yes often when you're young. The final thing here about pursuing opportunities is something that I've learned from Os Guinness. Bethany pushed this my way recently. I suggest you go watch this sermon on YouTube. I'm not sure what the name of the sermon is, but if you look up Os Guinness, he preaches about being entrepreneurial in the way we use our talents. And he uses the parable of the talents, and he says that too often, I don't know if he said too often, he said that what God doesn't do is tell you exactly how to use your talents. When he gave that man 10 and that man 5 and that man 1, he just expected them to take their talents and go figure out how to invest them. And he said, we should do this in ministry as well. We should think about what are the resources I have, and then how do I connect them to the needs in my community? or the needs in the world. And to be entrepreneurial, to say, what should I do? Instead of waiting for somebody to ask you, instead say, well, here are the resources and talents I have, and now how do I plug those into the needs of the world? And so one of the things you can do is ask yourself, what are the resources that I have? And I'm going to give you some ideas. So what influence do you have? What are your spheres of influence? And the little circles at the bottom, you can fill these in. Who can you influence? Another resource you might have is finances. Okay, so there's a resource I have. Another one might be skills and abilities that you have. Maybe areas of interest that you have. All of these are resources that you have. So if you put those in those circles, then ask yourself, what are the needs where these could fit? So what are the needs in the world where my skills and abilities? Where are the needs in the world where my finances? Where are the needs in the world where my influence can make a difference? And then he just was encouraging to say, just go do it. Like, just the way that if I had money and wanted to start a business, I would look for needs and I would take my resources and I'd connect them together. Do the same thing with our talents that the Lord has given us for ministry. What do I have? What are the resources? What are the needs? Connect the two. Maybe a story will help. There's a man in Vietnam. His name is Ganga. I think he's in Vietnam, who saw a need. He saw a lot of neglected children, and he realized that he and his wife could parent. All right, that was their resource that they had. That was their talent. He figured that they could parent 15 children at a time. That way they could take care of at least 15 children. 25 years later, they've had 70 children. They've adopted 70 children, because with 15 at a time, as they age out the top, you can keep adopting new children. And so they've had 70 children, and their dream is to plant a child in each of the 75 regions of their country. He said, that's the way we can extend our influence across this country. My children, I think he has now children, when I read about this, in 32 different regions of Vietnam. So there was a man who had a resource. He could be a dad. He saw a need, neglected children, and he said, well, how can I plug the two together and solve a problem? And he's doing beautifully with that. William Shakespeare once wrote that all the world's a stage. Do you know that line? And all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And then he describes the exits and entrances of a human life. Shakespeare captured some truth. Our lives are a little bit like a play that is being played out. God has this play. It started back there with Abraham. It's going on. And those of us in this room, we are now walking out on the stage of this play. We have a part to play. The question is, will we? We know the plot now. The plot of the play is that God is going to bless all the peoples of the earth through the redemption that comes through Jesus Christ. The question is, am I going to step out on the stage and will I play my part in the mission? 20 years from now, I don't know if you thought about this, Merle Burkholder is not going to be standing up on that platform. Probably not. I hope he is, but probably won't be doing a main session. Frank Reed may not be doing that. Alan Roth may not be doing that. Those of us in this room will need to take those roles in those places. It's our turn now to be involved in the mission. Let's embrace God's mission. To me, it clarifies a lot when I can just answer the question, what is God doing? God wants to bless all the nations of the earth through the redemption that is in Jesus Christ. And that blessing flows into our economic lives and into our health and into our families in so many ways and enriches us. So I urge all of us in this room to consider how we can be a part of the mission. And some of us are more in the stage of life where we're needing to prepare. Some of us are in the stage of life where maybe we need to sacrifice, let some things go. And all of us can pursue the opportunities that God gives us now. So let's start and let's spread the blessing of God throughout the whole earth. Thank you so much for coming. And Gary, do you have anything for us before we leave? Of whatever discussion. Let's see what we can generate here. Okay. Is it something you'd like to push back against? That would be more interesting than as something you want to agree with. Or do you have some other question? Yes. Yes. O.S. He's not really proud of his name, by the way. I think he was named after Oswald Chambers. O.S. Guinness. I think like the alcoholic beverage, Guinness, like beer. I don't know that that helps you a lot, but Guinness, G-U-I-N-N-E-S-S, something like that. Os Guinness. Yes. Anyone else? I think one of the things about when I started understanding God's mission in the terms that I gave you today, it gives me an overarching way to think about everything that's happening throughout Scripture, and also a way to plug in all the disparate things that we're involved in here. So here's Merle here with Anabaptist Foundation Financial, and here is Robert Stoll with, you know, Stoll Fireplaces, and he teaches school, and I'm an administrator, and somebody else is a pastor, but we all can have a part in God's mission. And then we don't have to always do big things. It can just be small things that plug in to blessing and advancing God's mission. Gary, I'm turning it over to you.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.